The following is an unpublished short story by James Beatty. A note at the top puts the date as 1st, 1998. Circa 2 p.m., written near midnight. And a further note states that the typescript was started June 3rd, 1998, circa 2:45 a.m. And a final note at the end mentions that the typescript was finished June 3rd, 1998, circa 9:03 p.m., or whatever that's worth. Dear Abby, by James Beatty, read by Goblin Hood. Dear Abby, for as long as I can remember, people have been writing to you at your newspaper column there, asking you questions about a variety of things. So I thought I'd write and ask you about this dream I had last night. In the dream, I was evidently a fledgling serial killer and sex offender of the worst possible sort. So, knowing of our tabloid culture's insatiable fascination with such matters, I thought it would be fun to share the dream with you and your readers. If it matters, I am a 46-year-old artist who lives alone, except for Goblin Hood, a performance art persona and alternate identity. He just consists of a handmade black mask with a painted spider and Martian harmlessness sigil on it. But he often seems alive in his own right, as do his sidekicks, the suitcase and cosmic weevil dolls, who are a couple of little handmade dolls. Weird as all that must sound, however, I can assure you that none of them had anything to do with the dream, nor it with them, because it just isn't their style, and because of that Martian sigil and, well, it's really too complicated to explain and would make my letter too long for your column, so please just take my word for it. My dream began with me and a young woman in an upstairs bedroom of a nondescript and unidentifiable house. It must have been deserted because the room was empty except for a chandelier. There wasn't even a bed. The woman was young, I guess, but she wasn't a little kid or anything. Still, she may not have been 18 years old yet, so whatever happened would probably have been statutory at best, even if it hadn't been homicidal. I must have lured or abducted her to that room or something, but I remember nothing about it, or about her. I don't even remember if I had her tied up or not. And I don't remember what actually took place between us. This is exceedingly weird and difficult to explain, but what I next experienced was actually a preview of a future movie about this terrible crime. The only scene that stuck in my mind was an image of a young girl's ass, seen partly from the side, and I mean young. The actress was either made up to look extremely young, much younger, I'm sure, than the actual woman involved, or may even have been an underage starlet doing a controversial nude scene, sort of like Brooke Shields in the film Pretty Baby. In this eerie dream preview scenario, the actress was kind of bent over, wearing a black shirt and thigh-length black socks, and her pale, naked buttocks were seen in extremely soft focus, the split between them just barely showing, sort of like an old penthouse photo back before Hustler upped the ante by showing pink. I couldn't help thinking how much more erotic and seductive this tasteful scene probably was by normal standards than would probably have been whatever sordid and horrendous thing was actually going on in that deserted bedroom. In any case, the preview scene strongly suggested an act of sodomy, or rather, anal rape. But that may simply have been Hollywood's cute way of making things more sensational than they already are, as Hollywood is often wont to do. At any rate, Abby, when the preview, or whatever it was, finally ended, I found myself back in that bedroom, as opposed to wherever I'd just been, while merely watching things. And I noticed that the woman was now dead, her slit throat looking oddly like makeup and special effects. And now, this is really hard to explain. My father was there with me, exulting in the hellishness of it all. He wasn't actually my real father, of course. He was just some older and more accomplished serial killer. He was kind of like my sponsor, and I was like his protege, a little like vampires in certain romanticized versions of that concept. And I also seemed to remember dimly from television shows like The X-Files and Millennium, having somehow acquired the notion that a predisposition for serial killing might be an inherited trait. But again, he was nothing like my genetic father in waking reality. It was just that in my dream, I thought of him as my father. He may or may not have helped me to dispose of the body. What he definitely did do, though, was to take me out to the barn to show me something that was out there. The house was evidently on a farm or something. Out in the barn, he showed me a haunted milking machine. It actually looked like a washing machine in a kind of horse stall. I don't know why I thought of it as a milking machine. Anyway, the machine was frantically bouncing up and down and spinning around, actually whirling around in its stall, apparently for all eternity. There was no visible power source, and seemed to suggest some kind of poltergeist activity. Now, I've always been slightly bored by and slightly contemptuous of what I choose to regard as Hollywood, quote, Spielbergisms, unquote, named after a famous director who used to simply wallow in this kind of stuff. These could be described as images and concepts exemplifying the childish notion that haywire machinery and everyday objects acting weird somehow equate to the very pinnacle of imaginative thought. They usually consist of flying bicycles, household appliances running amok, that sort of thing. It all strikes me as sort of puerile, though perhaps not quite as boneheaded as the ubiquitous car crashes and exploding buildings, which are a more mundane version of the same general idea. Anyway, at first glance, the haunted milking machine might seem to have been cut from that same dreary cloth, but for some reason it filled me with real horror. Perhaps this was because it wasn't obviously just some dim-witted special effects crap, but a real phenomenon in the context of the dream. Then, too, phenomena in dreams often display a kind of exaggerated sense of importance or even portentousness. Nor was this odd phenomenon ever truly explained, which added to its aura of terrible mystery. But I think what really got to me were its seeming implications. The implications were somehow suggested by what I saw through a window in the stall. There was another house next door to the barn, and that house was on fire. Both flames and screams emerged from an upstairs window. Then a fireman ran up with a ladder and climbed into that window, but he never climbed back out. Instead, that same fireman kept climbing up to that same window and disappearing inside over and over, and evidently forever. I remembered then a theory concerning ghosts that I'd read or heard about, to the effect that the spirits or souls of people who died violently were doomed to haunt the scenes of their deaths in perpetuity, presumably constantly reliving the terrible events, evidently like this fireman and the unseen fire victim inside. Perhaps something awful had also happened to the haunted milking machine to make its spirit or whatever act the way it was acting, or whatever. But it really struck me just how unfair this all was, that for a serial killer's victim, as an example, getting raped and murdered supposedly wasn't bad enough. Instead, the whole thing had to replay itself forever, too. I got the idea that my father was making me aware of all this with sadistic and even didactic glee, that it represented the serial killer's ultimate triumph, not only to wreck and end the victim's life, but to mess up the victim's afterlife as well. And I can't help thinking now about the smarmy, last-minute Christian conversion of executed serial killer Ted Bundy. I can't help picturing him in heaven, maybe talking about old times with some of his innocent victims, the ones who were Christians, of course, and thereby didn't automatically go to hell. And I can't help wondering just what kind of place heaven is, anyway. Anyway, I must have spent some subsequent time alone pondering this, as subsequent events seemed to indicate. But later, I found myself back in the house of my own recent crime, attending a semi-formal cocktail party in a large downstairs room, also empty except for a chandelier and a lot of elegant guests. My so-called father was also circulating suavely through the crowd, but it seemed that he couldn't have been there for very long, because the ceiling around the chandelier and the chandelier itself suddenly collapsed under the weight of a huge pile of murdered bodies in the room upstairs. My father, I could tell, had recently been really, really busy putting my own minimal and picayune effort to shame, making me look like the veriest of tyros. Most distressing of all, when I woke up just then, I found that I was possessed of a fierce and uncompromising erection. My question, Abby, is this. Do you think it's wrong to have dreams like that, even if I can't help it? And if so, could it mean that I've been watching too much television? Or do you think such dreams are normal for a man of my age and solitude, especially in a culture where someone like Jeffrey Dahmer could stay in the headlines for what seemed like ages? And what do you think the two chandeliers may have represented? Signed, Just Wondering, Columbus, Ohio. This is Goblin Hood, as a sort of a little postscript. One thing I remember about the preceding story was that I used it, typing it, that is, to inaugurate the receipt of a new typewriter, or rather an old typewriter, but new in the context of like what I've been doing, that was given to me or loaned to me or something by my friend Mary Forker and her husband Russell. Right about the time, maybe a week or two before this dream was written down. As for the dream itself, I have nothing really to say that wasn't already in there. Except that I chose to read this on this tape. The Oates story, Martyrdom, is one of the most perverse stories I've ever read. It's also one of the best written and one of the most slyly humorous. Her treatment of the rats, in particular, her delving into their miserable little world down there, really struck me as powerful. Whereas the baby girl stuff is like, obviously it's like in your face male chauvinist pigs kind of thing. But on the other hand, I've read a lot of Joyce Carol Oates, probably because she writes short stories. So I've come to, I've never read any of her novels because I hardly ever read novels anymore. But I've read a lot of her short stories, and I respect her a lot because, as Martyrdom points out, when she wants to get feminist, she gets there. I mean, she's like one of the best, but most of her stuff that I've read isn't really like that. It's more self-critical or self-examining or something. She's not quite as enamored of the great chasm between men and women as most of the more overtly feminist writers that I've read. It's usually there somehow. I mean, the husbands, for instance, in a lot of her stories tend to be just shadowy figures. Sometimes they're already dead, and the woman has outlived them. Sometimes they're just not there at all. So when she cuts loose with this stuff in a story like Martyrdom, it's something special. It's not like she's harping on it all the time, okay? I'm aware of it as much as anybody else, and, you know, I find it regrettable, but what can I say in view of the dream I just related? One reason I put that on this tape, I had some tape left over. And I'm thinking of taping my essay or story or whatever it is, Steel Bob and Monstrella, because that was written specifically for the triptych, about the triptych. And so if I'm going to be listening to this kind of stuff while I'm painting, I might as well listen to that. I haven't read that one since I finished typing it last year, almost a year ago. But I was like looking through my stuff to find that, and I found this Dear Abby story, and I thought, oh God, and I read it, and actually, I'm kind of pleased with it. It's got some very interesting things to say. The little case it sets up about heaven and hell, that's maybe not particularly fair, but I think these questions do need to be addressed. And particularly the idea of the victims who weren't Christians going to hell. I mean, whereas even hell might be better than just staying there and reliving the awful events for all eternity. I don't know. I had a dream last night that really disturbed me. There was nothing much to it, but in the dream I was going to go downstairs and boil some water to make macaroni, even though I don't, you know, eat macaroni very much. And by the way, the date right now is April 14th, 1999, and it's 6:24 p.m. right now. So the actual dream took place about 2-3 hours ago, because that's how long I've been up. Anyway, I was dreaming that I was going to get up and go downstairs and boil some water for macaroni. And from that point, I was going to go out to a gallery hop or something. I don't know what it was. Something involving the old version of the Acme Art Company. Anyway, in my dream, I get up out of bed and I go into the bathroom and spend a long time there. I may have even taken a bath or something, you know. I mean, so I was just like putting all this time into my ablutions. And then I go downstairs and the first thing I noticed was that the light was already on downstairs. And I go downstairs and I walk into the kitchen, and while the stove isn't where it's supposed to be, still, there's already a pot of water boiling on the stove. A kettle, you know, of water. All ready for me to dump some macaroni in there, which isn't exactly how I'd cook it. You know, I'd usually just put it in to begin with. It was also on a burner that normally doesn't work on the stove. The reason this disturbed me is because lately I've been like thinking a lot about somnambulism, which I know of exactly 3 episodes of that in my life. They're probably too complicated to go into here, but I've been thinking lately too that I get these weird itching sensations right along where my own jugular vein would be, and you don't really dare scratch there, because like I've scratched places on my arms, for instance, where, you know, the blood comes, and you don't want to do that on your neck. But what's to prevent you from doing that in your sleep? The sleepwalking that I've actually accomplished has convinced me that you can do virtually anything while you're asleep. That, in other words, there's no point in tying yourself up with manacles or something. That anything you can get out of when you wake up, you're going to be able to get out of while you're asleep. And you know, the funny thing is, it wouldn't even do to, you know, cut my fingers off or something. Because if that's the case, if that's what I want, you know, there's nothing to stop me from, like, walking in my sleep to the nearest pair of scissors and shoving that in my throat with the bloody stumps of my hands or whatever. So it's a kind of an imponderable thing. About the only thing you could do is turn yourself over to some, you know, place where you could be restrained and monitored while you sleep, and that's sort of, you know. I do know what triggered the dream last night, which was that as I was trying to go to sleep, I found myself unable to, and I got up to go use the bathroom, and I noticed before I even got out of bed that there was this weird glowing under the door of the bedroom, and that in fact I had left the light on in the bathroom, something normally I would never do. So that probably accounted for parts of the dream anyway, the idea of me, you know, going downstairs and the light's already on and so forth and so on. I throw all this in because, you know, I'm talking about Dear Abby in a way. I don't really regard us as being responsible for what we dream about, you know? It's like, you can regulate your conscious mind, in my experience and in my opinion. The more you try to regulate it, the harder you try to regulate it, the more stuff you try to repress and suppress, the more that stuff is going to come out in subconscious ways if it's there. Now, for somebody like me, who spends most of his conscious waking time attempting to be harmless and even worrying about pathetic, ridiculous things that I may have done wrong, the implications here are kind of, you know, grim, that I'm suppressing a lot, and it's going to come out in my sleep, you know, while I'm dreaming, at least. I like to remind myself that all three episodes of